thud with a thud. Ren immediately scoops her up and soothes her bruised ego before depositing her on the bed.
Is there anything else I can do for you, Señor Sawyer?
No, thank you, Antonio.
Very good, then. My number is on the desk in the foyer. If you need anything, do not hesitate to call.
Ren hands him a folded bill and says,
Thank you very much.
Antonio leaves the room, and it is only then that I fully realize it has been assumed that this room is for the two of us. I look at Ren. He is looking at me. Awkward, I say.
Don't worry, he says. I can sleep anywhere.
No, you take this room. I'll find another.
Stay, he says. I'll go get the luggage. You're here. I'm elsewhere.
I want to argue, but I can tell by the look on his face that it will do absolutely no good. He leaves the room, and I stand there for a moment, feeling like Alice in Wonderland. I flop back first onto the bed, arms and legs splayed, staring at the ceiling. What am I doing here? I know Ty, and if last night left him angry enough to go to the Italian police and file a complaint, I can only imagine what he will do if he finds out that I have fled the scene with Ren and am hiding out in an Italian villa. It's not like that, but I guess it would appear like that. My hope is to simply give him time to cool off and change his mind about trying to have the last word. Ren appears in the doorway then with my suitcase, laptop, and camera bag.
Did someone call for a porter?
He says. I vault off the bed, walk over, and take two of the bags from him. He puts my suitcase in the closet, then turns to look at me.
The pool looked inviting. Are you up for it?
I do have a swimsuit, but the thought of putting it on and actually wearing it in front of Ren is enough to make me plead a headache and a need for an afternoon nap. Oh, I don't know. I'm really not much of...
Come on,
he says.
It'll be fun. I'm sure they have extra suits here if you need one.
I have one, as well as a cover-up, I add under my breath.
What was that?
Nothing.
Okay. Well, I'll see you downstairs in 15 minutes.
Sure. Sophia dive bombs off the bed and follows him from the room, her tail a cotton ball blur. I watch them go and then close the door behind them. I honestly do not think I can make myself put on that bathing suit and actually wear it in front of him. I picture Gretchen Maha as she had looked on the cover of Sports Illustrated last year, another byproduct of my Google searching. And I nearly wilt at my own mental comparison. Oh, well, that's what cover-ups are for, and mine will be staying on.
36. Ren. Sophia and I beat Lizzie to the pool. I will actually be surprised if she comes at all, considering that her reluctance to agree could not have been more obvious. I throw a towel across a chair at one end of the pool, stretch out face down, running my hand through the warm blue water. I hear her sandals on the stone floor and look up. She looks as if she would rather be anywhere else in the world. With the benefit of my sunglasses, I start to say something, but then my gaze snags on her long tan legs, and I take advantage of my sunglasses to admire them a moment or two longer. I rise up on my elbows and say, Hey, you came.
I did,
she says. I get up and pull a chair next to mine. She sits down, cover up securely in place. I look over at her, raise an eyebrow. Aren't you a little warm in that?
No, actually, I was just thinking it's a bit chilly out here.
I pick up my phone, tap the weather app, and show her the screen. 83 degrees.
Oh, well, maybe I'll warm up in a bit.
You can't swim in a cover-up.
Who says I'm swimming?
I do, I say. I stand, reach for her hand, and pull her up from the chair. Either take it off or you're going in with it.
You wouldn't dare.
5 seconds. 4. 3. two. When she shows no signs of removing it, I pick her up, walk to the deep end of the pool. She's beating at my chest and kicking. Sophia is now running after us and barking. Last chance, I say, sticking one foot over the edge of the pool.
Ren?
I step off, and we both slice through the water. I hold on to her all the way down and all the way back up. When we cut through the surface, she's sputtering, and to my surprise, I'm smiling.
I cannot believe you did that.
I did give you fair warning. The cover-up now clings to her curves, and I have no idea why she doesn't want to be seen in a bathing suit. She pushes off my chest and starts to swim away. I reach out and grab her foot and reel her back in. I snag an arm around her waist and get us both to a point where I can stand, all the while not letting her go. There is no denying my awareness of her. I can see it on her face, the way it makes her lips go slightly slack and deepens the color of her eyes. What are we doing, Lizzie? I ask, my voice barely audible. She stares up at me for several long heartbeats before saying,
Being foolish?
I shake my head. I don't feel foolish. I reach out and trace my finger along the edge of her jaw.
What do you feel, then?
Like I found something I never knew I was looking for. And now that I know it exists, the thought of letting it go feels like a great big hole in the center of me. She starts to say something, presses her lips together, and then begins again.
This isn't real, Ren. People like you and me don't do things like this.
Like what?
Step outside of their real lives and be something else.
Do you think we're not being ourselves?
No, I don't think we are.
I think you're wrong about that. I think maybe we've both figured out that there's another way to live.
But there isn't,
she says. She puts her palms against my chest and tries to push away. There is, I say. I think you've shown me that. She shakes her head.
Don't, Ren, don't. This is... Don't. You can't do this.
Do what?
Pretend that this can go somewhere.
Why can't it? I ask.
Because,
she says, dropping her head back and staring up at the sky. I hear the slightest sigh escape her lips, and I know I'm not wrong about what's between us.
I don't think you have any idea how different our lives are, she says.
I take her hand, lead her to the shallow end of the pool. I lift her up and set her on the side, standing in front of her, one arm on either side of her hips. You have no idea, I say, what you've done for me, Lizzie. She's fully focused on me, confusion clear in her eyes. When I boarded that flight out of the U.S., I didn't intend to ever return.
What do you mean?
She asks carefully. I mean, I stop because the words are too hard to say.
What?
She asks, and I hear the concern in her voice. She puts two fingers under my chin and forces me to look at her.
Tell me.
I didn't want to live that life anymore.
You wanted to quit your music?
I don't answer for several moments. And then, I wanted to quit my life. Hearing myself say it out loud feels like a punch to the stomach. I see the shock settle onto her face. She starts to say something, then stops and shakes her head.
Why would you... Ren, why?
I get out of the pool, sit on the edge next to her, my palms braced on either side of me. I don't say anything for a good while. And when I do, I hear the shame in my voice. I've done some pretty awful things, Lizzie.
Everyone makes mistakes, Ren.
Yeah, I say, and I hear the word break in half. But has everyone caused their own brother's death? I cannot look at her. I feel her looking at me, and I can no more turn my face to hers than I can remove this lead weight from my chest. She places her left hand over my right, links our fingers together as if she feels a sudden need to anchor me.
You could never do that.
I did, I say.
What?
She asks, shaking her head. I've never told anyone else in my life what happened that weekend. But I need to now in a way that I cannot turn away from. I am fully aware that in doing so I might open her eyes to a man she wants nothing to do with. But I need to know, more than I need to breathe right now, whether this fallen version of me is a man she could ever accept. I loved my brother, Lizzie, I say. I loved him. But I killed him.
37. Lizzie. I hear the words, and yet they make absolutely no sense to me, like letters that have been switched to make sounds I've never heard before. But his death was an accident. I read about the bus crash. He looks up at me, and I have never seen deeper regret than what I see in his blue eyes right now.
It should have been me, he says. I should have been on that bus in that seat. Colby was sitting in my seat because I wasn't there, and our drummer was sitting in Colby's regular seat. He was fine.
Ren, you can't...
I can,
he interrupts me.
I can.
His voice slices through my protest.
You remember how I told you I wasn't a very good guy?
I know you said that, I say, but I don't believe it.
I didn't get on the bus that day. I was supposed to. Colby's fiancée asked me not to. She said she had something she wanted to talk to me about. I knew on some level what she wanted. We used to date, and a couple of years after we broke up, she and Colby started dating. I should never have stayed behind that night. If I hadn't, he would be here, and I wouldn't.
Ren, you don't know that.
I loved my brother, he says, his voice hardly recognizable. And if it weren't for me...
Stop, I say softly. Stop. I slip my arms around his neck and pull him to me. I can feel how close he is to breaking, and I want nothing more in this world than to hold him together. I lean back and press my hand to the side of his face. He looks at me, and I honestly feel as if I could drown in his sorrow. You didn't mean for him to die, Ren.
No,
he says.
I just wish it had been me instead of him.
38. Ren. We sit at the pool for most of the afternoon. We talk very little, but somehow I don't need that with her. Just having her next to me is enough. Lizzie isn't judging me. I feel that, and I'm grateful for it. Undeserving of it, but grateful. We agree to meet downstairs for dinner around 7. After I go upstairs and change, I head out for a run. I'm not sure how long I'm out there or how far I go, but I run full out as if something in the effort can leech from me the guilt that's become part of my every breath, every heartbeat. I run until I have to stop and bend over at the knees, pulling in air, my lungs frantic for the next gulp of oxygen. I'm almost back to the villa when my phone rings. I glance at the screen, see that it's Stuart, and consider not answering. But I know I owe him for finding this place so quickly. So I do.
Have you seen the news?
He snaps. And I know this is not going to be pleasant. No, I say. I haven't.
Well, you've made entertainment headlines.
I want to tell him I couldn't care less, but I can hear in his voice he's going to tell me anyway.
Who is she?
She? I keep the question neutral.
The woman whose picture is splattered all over Entertainment Nightly. I'm assuming she's the reason you needed a place to hide out.
It's not like that, Stuart.
What is it like, Ren? They're saying you beat the crap out of her husband.
It wasn't like that either.
Then exactly what was it like?
He asks, his voice starting to rise.
Apparently he's filing charges against you.
Apparently, I agree.
Is that what you were running from?
I'm not running.
It looks like running. Just so you know, the headlines are pretty ugly.
You should know by now that I don't give a damn about the headlines.
Headlines are one thing. Assault charges another. This is serious. They've been calling me here in New York. Pictures of you two are surfacing in some town called San Gimignano. Look, I don't care who you have an affair with, Ren, but the legal stuff you don't need.
We're not having an affair, I say. It sure looks like it from here. Goodbye, Stuart.
Ren!
I click off before another word floats up from my phone. I walk back to the villa, go upstairs, and stand under a cool shower for 10 minutes. With the pounding of the spray comes clarity. I have to let her go. Home. To either fix her life or change it.
39. Ty. You open your eyes to bright sunlight trying to break through the heavy curtain of the hotel room. You squint against the light that is successful at penetrating. You rise up on one elbow, try to make out the numbers on the clock beside the bed, only to discover it's already the middle of the afternoon. You start to sit up, then groan when your face remembers the pain in your jaw. You cup a hand to the swollen spot, trying not to wince at the throbbing. Damn it all to hell. You throw your legs over the side of the bed and walk to the bathroom, rummaging through your overnight case in search of some Advil. You find a bottle, dump out two, and then swallow them with a glass of water. You stand with your palms planted on the edge of the sink, forcing yourself to assess the damage to your face in the mirror. Your left eyelid is swollen and starting to turn purple. Your fists clench automatically. You wish you could have another shot at that asshole and his way too perfect face. You wonder what his agenda is. He has to have one. What other reason could he possibly have for being with Lizzie? You've seen pictures of him in magazines with models, actresses, other singers. Lizzie? A housewife from Virginia? You spend your days trying to arrange events into patterns of logic, but there is no pattern to be found here. Lizzie is pretty. You're not blind to that fact. Or at least at one time you thought so. But is she in a league with the kind of women Sawyer is usually seen with? No. What then is his motivation? You walk back to the bedroom, sit down on the side of the bed, and lean forward with your head in your hands. Does it even matter? Do you even care? Some part of you does. You can't deny it. You're just not sure which part. The you who married her, or the you who imagines being the laughingstock among your friends. Lizzie leaving you for a rock star? You're pretty sure that as a teenager, Kylie had a poster of Sawyer hanging on her bedroom wall after going to one of his concerts. That's some irony. You're beginning to wonder if you ever should have involved the police. What if it gets in the papers? Shows up back home? Your face heats up with embarrassment, even at the thought of it. Should you drop the charges? The idea of letting him off the hook burns like acid in your gut. But then you wouldn't be doing it for him. You'd be doing it for yourself. Just as you're about to dial the number left with you by the Italian police, your phone rings. The screen reads unknown number. You answer with a cautious, "Hello?" "Mr. Harper?" "Yes." "It's Peyton Kinley, Kylie's roommate." You can hear now that her voice is shaking. Your heart starts to pound. "Yes, Peyton, what is it?"
"I found your contact info on Kylie's computer. Mr. Harper, I don't know how to tell you this, but Kylie, we can't find her. No one knows where she is."
For a moment, the words refuse to penetrate, and you can't bring yourself to respond.
"Mr. Harper?"
"What do you mean no one can find her, Peyton?"
"We went to a bar to see a band. She never came home. I went home for the day, and when I got back, I could tell she hadn't been in the room."
"Are you sure?" you ask, hearing the sharp edges in your voice. Peyton starts to cry.
"Yes, Mr. Harper, I'm sure. I've been asking around, and she wasn't in her classes today. No one has seen her."
"Have you called the police yet?"
"No, I haven't told anyone. I wanted to check with you first."
You force calm into your voice when you say, "Peyton, listen to me carefully. I want you to call the campus police and report her as missing. I'll call the Charlottesville police and do the same.
I'll give them your phone number so they can get in touch with you. I'm in Italy right now, but I'll catch the first available flight back. I imagine D.C. will be the best I can do, and then I'll drive to Charlottesville from there.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Harper,
Peyton says, her sobs now nearly eclipsing her words.
I really don't know where she could be.
Did she leave the bar with anyone? Silence hangs on the line, and then...
The singer from the band, I think. But they've already left town.
Tell the police everything you know, Peyton. Everything. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
I'll check in with you as often as I can. If there's any news, please call me and leave a message if I don't answer.
I will.
You hang up, feeling as if you've taken a right hook to the center of your chest. You sit for a moment and try to organize your thoughts, figure out what is best to do first. And then you just start moving, one action in front of the other. Open your laptop. Find the number for the Charlottesville Police Department. Call, wait impatiently until you're put through to a woman who takes your information, what little you have to give her. You tell her you're out of the country, and that you'll get back as fast as you can. It's clear that she's assessing your words, drawing a conclusion perhaps that you're an overprotective father, who might be a little too quick to judge a situation that will probably end up being nothing more than a girl taking advantage of freedom. And so you say, "This is not like my daughter. She doesn't do things like this." "I'm sure, Mr. Harper. But college kids have a way of proving us wrong." You end the call, unconvinced that she has taken you seriously. You start to dial the airline, and then think about Lizzie. Should you leave her here and not bother to tell her? But then if this doesn't bring her to her senses, what will? You have no way to get in touch with Lizzie, no idea where she is now. You consider your options. Few come to mind. But why can't you direct your message to Sawyer, if she's still with him? You pick up your phone and tap the Twitter icon. In the search bar at the top, you type in his name, Ren Sawyer. Wait to see if he has an account. Of course he does. You click the tweet screen and type, at Ren Sawyer. May I please have my wife back? Our daughter is missing. And you tweet it.
40. Ren. We are outside on the terrace having a glass of wine after dinner. We said very little during the meal, and I think it's because we both know we're at an impasse. I've been trying to work up my courage for the past 2 hours, trying to find the words to say what I want to say to her. I line them up in my mind, wanting them to come out as I feel them. But all of a sudden I have the confidence of a teenage boy, and I stumble into the words, awkward and unsure. There's something I'd like to say to you, Lizzie. She sets her wine glass on the wall in front of us, glancing up at me with a look in her eyes that makes me wonder if she wants to hear it.
Okay, she says.
I never expected any of this. Meeting you, spending time together the way we have.
Neither did I,
she agrees quietly. But I'm so glad that I did meet you.
And I'm glad I met you.
I don't want it to end here.
I don't want it to end here,
she says, reaching out to put her hand over mine. I can feel that she's shaking. I'm not asking you to say anything now, Lizzie. We both have loose ends to tie up in our lives if we go anywhere beyond this. Just don't say no to us. She then lets her gaze meet mine, and I know she's feeling what I'm feeling. It's there in her eyes, undeniable. I brush the back of my hand across her cheek, and lean in and kiss her as I've been wanting to do all day. Her response tells me she's been thinking about it too. And so I slide my arms around her waist, lifting her up onto the wall and stepping in between her legs, pulling her as close as it is possible to do with both of us wearing clothes.
Ren,
she begins, common sense in her voice. But as soon as I start to pull back, she wraps her arms around my waist and stops me from going anywhere. We hold on to each other as if we're poised on the edge of a cliff, and we can only save each other by never letting go. And then she's the one kissing me, her hand sliding beneath my T-shirt, up my back, her thumbs tracing my spine. I shiver beneath her touch, dropping my mouth to the side of her neck, my hand sliding her dress off one shoulder so I can kiss the ridge of her collarbone. She slides my shirt up and over my head, leaning back to study me with a gaze of pure want. She kisses the center of my chest and begins making her way lower, her lips leaving a fire in their wake. Lizzie. I lift her up, cupping her face in my hands. If you don't stop that, in about 60 seconds, I'll be begging you to come upstairs with me.
You don't have to beg,
she says, rubbing her thumb across my lower lip.
Will you?
What? I ask, the question barely audible.
Take me upstairs.
You don't mean it, I say, anchoring my hand in the back of her hair.
I do mean it,
she says, and pulls my mouth back to hers. I feel the truth in her kiss, and for a little while I make myself forget everything except what we have right here together. My phone beeps from its spot on the wall next to us. Lizzie leans away to glance at it, but my phone is the last thing I want to look at right now.
You have a text,
she says, putting her hands against my chest. Later, I say, kissing the side of her neck.
It has exclamation points,
she says, picking it up and handing it to me. I glance at it with reluctance. It's from Stuart. Check your Twitter account now, please. Is he serious? I say out loud.
Looks that way,
Lizzie says. I swipe the screen until I find the Twitter icon that I rarely use. I tap it open and click on notifications. I scroll through, not seeing anything worthy of Stuart's exclamation points. And then I spot the name Ty Harper and the tweet he'd posted a little over 30 minutes ago. At Ren Sawyer, may I please have my wife back? Our daughter is missing. My stomach drops, but I force myself to read it again with skepticism. Based on the Ty Harper I met, I wouldn't put it past him to be making the whole thing up. But then what if he isn't?
Is everything all right?
Lizzie asks. I don't know, I say, wishing I didn't have to show her the message. But I can't keep it from her. I hand her the phone and wait while she reads the tweet from her husband.
Oh no,
she says softly.
This can't be. I have to call him.
Of course, I answer. I'll give you some privacy. I step away and pick Sophia up from her spot on the chair next to Lizzie. I carry her with me into the house, closing the glass pane door behind us with a quiet click.
41. Lizzie. My heart is beating so fast and my hand is shaking so hard that I can barely dial Ty's number. The phone rings 5 times before he answers with a suspicious, hello. It's me. What's happened, Ty?
Kylie's roommate called. She said Kylie hasn't been back to the room since they went to some club to see a band.
When was that?
About 36 hours ago.
He says. And no one has seen her since then?
No.
Panic rises up in a wave. I force myself to try to think. Have the police been called?
I just spoke to someone in Charlottesville. They're looking into it.
We have to go back, I say.
I'm booking the next available flight out of Rome. It leaves at 7 a.m. Can you make it?
I have no idea, but somehow I will find a way. I have to. Yes. Can you text the information to this phone?
I'll see you at the airport,
he says and ends the call. The door opens and Ren walks out onto the terrace, his dark hair and his tan face drawing my gaze.
Is it true?
He asks. I nod, unable to hold back the waterfall of tears rushing up and out of me. He walks over and sits on the wall next to me, putting his arm around my shoulders and pulling me close. I have to go, I say.
I know,
he says, kissing my hair. My flight is at 7 out of Rome.
I'll get you there.
For a few seconds, and I force myself to count them, I lean into him, draw in his quiet strength, breathe in the scent of him. I never want to forget it, or the way it feels when he holds me like this. I try to let each of these things imprint themselves on my memory. I somehow know that once I leave here, that is all I will have to remember him by for the rest of my life.
42. Kylie. She's deep, deep underwater. Holding her breath, she pushes toward the surface, kicking her legs and propelling her way up, up, up. She's not sure if she'll be able to hold it long enough to make it all the way to the top. There's light there. She can see it. She tells herself she can do it, that she has the reserve to make it. Keep swimming. Keep going. Almost there. Finally, she breaks through the surface of the light. But it's not water she's broken through. It's consciousness. Her eyes fly open and panic hits her in a wave. "Hey," a voice says, and Kylie recognizes it as the girl who is also in the room with her. "What day is it?" Kylie asks, head throbbing, her mouth so dry she can barely get the words out. "I'm not sure," the girl says. "Don't scream," she adds, "or they'll just come back and knock you out again. It's lonely in here when you're not awake." Kylie forces herself not to do exactly that, every instinct telling her to scream at the top of her lungs. But she doesn't want to be drugged again, so she keeps her voice low when she says, "What's your name?" "Aaron." "I'm Kylie," she says. "Where are you from, Kylie?" "I go to UVA," Kylie says. "Where are you from?" "I live about an hour away from Charlottesville. I was walking to the store down the road from my house when this car pulled up behind me and a guy got out so fast I didn't even realize what was happening until he pushed me inside." "That's what they did to me, too," Kylie says. "Have you heard them say anything else?" "I think they're planning to sell us," Aaron says.
"What?"
"I heard them talking outside the door about how much money they'll get." And then Kylie remembers what she'd heard them say as well, that they couldn't be damaged.
"This can't be," Kylie says.
"I know. Only on TV, right?"
"There's got to be some way for us to get out of here."
Aaron jerks at the cuff on her wrist and shakes her head.
"I've tried. I mean later, when they start to take us wherever they're taking us."
"That's probably going to be our only chance," Aaron says. Kylie hears the resignation in her voice, as if she can no longer think about the likely outcome of their situation. But fight flares up inside her, and she tells herself they can't just give up and let themselves be taken somewhere far away, where they're probably going to do horrible things to them. "Think, Kylie," she tells herself. She knows she has to be smarter than those two thugs. They need a plan. She leans her head back against the bed, closes her eyes, and tries to concentrate. She notices she is sitting in some kind of liquid. She looks down, sees a spot on her dress, and realizes she has wet herself. It is only then that she begins to cry.
43. Ren. It takes us almost 3 hours to get to Rome. The traffic is nearly non-existent since we're driving through the night. I drive while Lizzie stares out the window with Sophia curled up on her lap. Several times I try to find words that might comfort her, but I don't have any. What can I say that will stop all the scenarios I know must be going through her mind? All the possibilities based on the horrible things we learn about on the news every single day. At one point I reach across and take her hand, linking my fingers through hers and holding on tight, because I can't think of another single measure of comfort to offer her. And with every mile that slips past on the car's odometer, I feel an approaching sense of loss, like a hole of quicksand in my heart. I know it's not really possible to lose something that was never really yours, but I feel the loss all the same. Lizzie asks if I will drop her at the terminal in the interest of saving time. I'd like to walk you in, I say.
I appreciate it, Ren, but it's probably better this way.
I know she means that Ty will be waiting inside, and I know that she's right. I nod my okay and drive to the United Airlines drop-off, pulling over and putting the car in park. We both sit staring out the windshield, waiting for the other to speak first. You're gonna blame yourself for what's happening to your daughter, aren't you? She bites her lower lip and then says,
If I hadn't been here, she might have come home, or...
Don't do that, okay? Promise me you won't do that.
Even if it's true?
You don't know that.
I know I've been acting like something I'm not.
Please don't belittle what we've been to each other here.
That's not my intention.
She hesitates before adding,
I don't know how to thank you for...
You have nothing to thank me for, Lizzie. I'm the one who should be thanking you.
No,
she says, shaking her head.
I think we both needed a friend, and just found each other at the right time.
I turn then, wanting to see her face when she answers my next question. Is that how you see me, Lizzie? As a friend? Her eyes fill with tears as she stares back at me.
We both know it can never be more than that.
Do we? She nods, biting her lower lip.
I think I just got caught up in feeling desirable again.
I look into her eyes. You are desirable. You are desired. We study each other for several long moments, and it feels as if we're both trying to store away this memory of each other.
You will never know,
she starts. I reach across and put my thumb to her jawline, rubbing back and forth. I know, I say. I hope you know.
I do,
she says. I lean in then and kiss her, a whisper of a kiss that lets me taste her tears. She kisses me back, deeper, with open longing and regret. And it's just as I reach for her to pull her closer that she moves away, crying openly now. She lifts Sophia, kisses her face on both sides, and then hands her to me.
I'll get my things from the back, she says.
Let me help, Lizzie, I say.
No, please. It's easier this way.
She gets out of the car, closes the door, and quickly opens the hatch, lifting her bags out and then shuts it. I watch as she walks through the airport's sliding doors. I wait for her to look back, but she doesn't.
44. Lizzie. Ty is waiting at the ticket counter. Before he spots me, I see him looking at his watch, the impatience that flits across his face. He looks up then, catches sight of me, leans over and says something to the woman behind the check-in counter. She nods and begins typing on the computer. Ty doesn't look at me when he says, "She needs your passport." I pull it from my bag and hand it to the woman who continues punching keys. "We'll be lucky if we make the boarding," Ty says in a clipped voice. "I'm sorry," I say. "Are you?" he says, his voice low, and I hear the accusation underscoring the question. The woman looks up and then quickly back at her computer screen. I feel my face heat up. I press my lips together and don't answer. We don't speak again until the plane is in the air. The seats are in business class, but I can tell that Ty finds them less than satisfactory based on the way he glances toward the first-class cabin, as if that's where he belongs. "Did you speak with anyone else after we talked?" I finally ask. "No," he says abruptly. "I did check her credit card usage. There have been no charges since the bar Peyton said they went to." My stomach drops with this information. Kylie constantly uses her credit card, Starbucks a couple of times a day, Amazon, the mall. "Where could she be?" I ask, my voice breaking on the words.
"I don't know,"
he says in a tone that I do not recognize as the Ty of recent years. Confident, arrogant. This is the Ty from long, long ago, a version of him that I'm not sure I even remembered once existed. What if we don't find her? He says. Don't, I say. Please, don't say that. He stares at the seat in front of him for a minute or more before he looks over at me and says,
How did we get here, Lizzie?
I let myself meet his gaze and see in his eyes someone I once knew. One choice at a time, I say.
And do you think I'm responsible for all the choices that got us here?
No, I say. It takes two people to mess up a marriage.
I know I'm more to blame than you are,
he says, surprising me with the sincerity in the admission. And both of us have plenty of reason to be mad at each other right now. For emphasis, he runs the palm of his hand over his bruised jaw. Guilt stabs at me. I start to respond, but he stops me with,
When we get back to Virginia, Lizzie, we're going to need each other. We both need to be there for Kylie. Can we do that?
I think of our daughter, and a dozen different scenarios of horror try to overtake my deliberate calm. I know that Ty is right, and that nothing else in the world matters right now except getting our daughter back, making sure she is safe.
We'll do whatever we need to do,
Ty says, and I hear that some of his confidence has returned. His belief that if you push back hard enough, the world will give you what you want.
Okay,
he asks, reaching over to take my hand in his. Okay, I say, and force myself not to pull away. 45. Lizzie. I want to sleep. I long for the oblivion it would bring, the blanking out of everything that is happening right now. But I can't, and I know I won't. It feels as if every muscle in my body is strung tight with worry, the fearful kind that overtakes every cell, every thought. As a mother, it's something I've thought of countless times. What if someone took my child? When Kylie was a little girl, I was anxious about it to the point of overprotectiveness. In public places, the grocery store, restaurants, I wouldn't let her out of my sight. Ty said I smothered her and that I needed to loosen the apron strings. As she grew older, I forced myself to be more reasonable about my fears, but it wasn't easy. And even after she became a teenager and started going out with friends, this was something I struggled with. So I did everything I could have to increase her ability to protect herself. Anything I could think of to encourage her to be careful. I stare out of the window of the plane at the clouds below, feeling numb with disbelief. I think about how little we actually know and consider other explanations for where Kylie might be. Ty said she left the bar with the singer from the band. The irony of this does not escape me. Instead, it pries the lid from the guilt waiting to get a foothold alongside the worry. Maybe Kylie is with him. It's not outside the realm of possibility. The past week of my own life is evidence enough of that. But why wouldn't she be answering her phone? Why would she not tell Peyton where she was going? I don't think she would do that. Even if she completely lost her head over a boy, she would let someone know where she was. This reality pushes hard against my chest, and I feel the bruise starting to form. Would this have happened if I hadn't gone ahead and taken the trip to Italy by myself? Logically, I know these dots do not connect, but I also know I made a choice to step outside my regular role of wife and mother. I was somewhere I shouldn't have been, doing something I never should have been doing. Ty shifts in the seat beside me. He raises his head, looks at me with sleep-cloudy eyes.
You should try to get some rest.
I'm okay.
I keep thinking,
he says, resting his head against the seat.
She wanted to come home this weekend. If I hadn't come to Italy to find you.
He stops there and shuts his eyes. but he doesn't need to finish. I know what he was going to say. If he hadn't come to Italy to find me, none of this would ever have happened.
46. Ty. The plane lands at Dulles almost exactly 9.5 hours after leaving Rome. You feel like you haven't slept in a week, and realize that you probably look like it, too. You slept a couple of hours, at least. You're pretty sure Lizzie didn't sleep any. As soon as the plane lands, you start trying to call Peyton, but only get her voicemail. You dial the number the detective left for you, but get a message there as well. You're among the first off the plane, and you lead the way down the corridor, checking the signs for baggage claim. After getting your luggage and forging your way through customs, you notice a group of photographers standing up ahead. You stop, and Lizzie bumps into you from behind. "What is it?" she asks. "There," you hear one of them say. "That's them!" Lizzie shakes her head. "They're not here for us, are they?" But then suddenly the photographers and what appear to be reporters with microphones rush toward them, all speaking at once. "Mr. and Mrs. Harper, could we have a word with you, please?" A tall, blonde woman in a pencil-thin navy dress steps out from the throng and says, "Mrs. Harper, we understand that you've been spending time in Italy with Ren Sawyer, the lead singer with Temporal." "And Mr. Harper," another man behind her speaks up, "is it true that you had an altercation with Mr. Sawyer while you were in Italy?" You reach for Lizzie's hand and start pulling her through the pile of media people. Someone from the airport begins to shout at the reporters, telling them they need to back away from the corridor so that other passengers might exit. You lead Lizzie through the crowd, both of you with your heads down, even as you feel the flash of light and sound of cameras clicking away. "Is it true, Mr. Harper, that your daughter is missing? Or was that just a ploy to get your wife away from Ren Sawyer?" You start to stop and give the reporter the swing he deserves. But now it's Lizzie pulling you past the airport gates, walking faster and faster until finally they are out of sight. Only then do you let go of her hand.
47. Lizzie. It feels as if the drive from D.C. to Charlottesville takes days, when in actuality it's only a couple of hours. Ty drives the rental car at the speed limit and over when he can. About halfway there, he finally gets Kylie's roommate on the phone, only to learn that there's still no news, no sign of her anywhere. "What do we do when we get there?" I ask as soon as he finishes talking with Peyton. "How do we even know where to begin?"
"We'll start with the police," Ty says. "We'll just start there, and we won't stop until we find her."
I stare out the window at the green pastures we're passing, and I can't help but think of other parents I've seen interviewed on the news. Their optimism in the beginning, their determination to bring their children home. And then later, down the road when they still haven't been found, those same parents, weary and beaten down, defeated. I close my eyes and I start to pray. I know in my heart there is absolutely nothing else I can do.
48. Kylie. "We're probably not going to get out of this, you know." Aaron's voice rouses Kylie from half-sleep. "Don't say that," she says. "Well, you know it's most likely true." "No, I don't." They both get quiet, and Kylie begins trying to leaf through her memory for something, anything, that might help them. She thinks through the self-defense class her mom had made her take. Each of the tactics taught to her by a male instructor, who insisted that if they knew the right things to do, it wouldn't matter how much stronger a man was. Smart trumped strength every time. Except, Kylie realizes now, when the element of surprise is involved. It's only then that she remembers the documentary she and her mom had watched together the year before Kylie left for college. She hadn't wanted to watch it. She'd had plans to go out that night, and the last thing she'd wanted to do was stay home with her mom and watch TV.
but her mom had already watched it, and she'd thought it was the kind of thing young girls could benefit from seeing. It was about some teenage girl in California who had been abducted from her home by a man who took her to his house, and for the first couple of days, repeatedly raped her and told her he was going to kill her. The point of the documentary was that for whatever reason, the girl felt that the best thing she could do was try and be a friend to her captor. Hope that he wouldn't see her as an object, but as another human being. So she forced herself to talk to him, ask him questions about himself, tell him things about herself, personal things that she sensed they would have in common. In doing this, she eventually gained his trust and was able to get away. Kylie remembers sitting on the couch with her mom, watching the story unfold, remembers how resentful and defiant she had been. Regret swoops through her for the way she'd spoken to her mom, for how she'd belittled the thought that there was anything to be gained from her staying home and watching the show. She thinks then about the two men who had kidnapped her, the one who had said he didn't see anything wrong with sampling the goods. And from there, Kylie begins to come up with a plan.
49. Wren. Sophia and I wander around the villa for the first few hours after we get back from the airport. I finally settle into a chair outside by the pool, a book on my lap. The words refuse to process, though, and I close it, dropping my head back to stare at the blue sky above. The house feels completely empty now. The only thing I can compare Lizzie's leaving to is losing my brother, knowing I would not see him again in this life. Watching Lizzie walk away from the car at the airport felt final in the same way. It hardly makes sense, given how little time we actually spent together. But the connection I feel with her is one I've never known with any other woman, and I've known a lot of women. The difference with Lizzie is that she knows next to nothing about the life I've lived in the spotlight. When she looks at me, I think she sees the me before all of that, without all of that. And yet, I'm not diminished in her eyes. As for her reaction to the truth about my brother's death, I'd expected her to look at me completely different, to see me as I see myself. But that hadn't been the case. I could see that she felt compassion for me, but not blame. Only the quiet insistence that I eventually needed to forgive myself. I want to. I want to go on with life. That much I do know now. I look down at the puppy snuggled in the curve of my arm. I think of what a small thing it was to offer her safety and a home. A small thing for me, but a big thing for her. Doing that for her has given me a satisfaction I haven't felt in a very long time. And I realize that I want my life to be more of that kind of thing and less of what it has been for the past dozen years. If I'm going to stay on this earth, I'd like to work at changing things for others, making lives better in whatever way I can. I have more money than I will ever be able to spend on myself. Money that can do a lot of good. I realize that continuing my career in any way will only mean something to me if I use it as a catalyst for good. And somewhere deep in my heart, I think Colby would agree.
50. Lizzie. We meet with the police for several hours. I never imagined how many questions they could come up with to ask. They want to know everything. Her habits. Her friends. Any trouble she might have ever been in. Whether she's promiscuous. Does drugs. Drinks alcohol. Detective Haley, the woman who asks most of the questions, finally appears to take pity on us. She runs a hand through her thick auburn hair and says, "I think that's everything for now. I apologize for the intrusive nature of the questioning, but sometimes it's the smallest detail that helps us find a missing person." "We understand," Ty says, his voice clipped in the way it gets when he wants to be done with a conversation. The detective's phone rings. She picks it up. "Detective Haley." We wait while she listens and finally says, "Okay. Thanks for letting me know. That was Detective Miller with the police department in Alexandria, Virginia, she says, putting down the phone and looking across the table at us. They located the singer from the band. He's been questioned thoroughly. It sounds as if she did leave the room sometime during the night. He passed a lie detector test. I absorb her words, at first relieved to know that he didn't have anything to do with her disappearance, and then almost instantly sick with fear for all the other possible explanations. I lace my hands together in my lap, searching for the courage to ask my next question. Will you find her? The detective looks at me with compassion in her eyes. I wonder how many other families she's had ask her the same question. We're doing everything we can, she says. Please, know that we understand every hour counts. Your daughter's case has my full attention. Are you a mother? I ask, my voice breaking across the word. Yes, I am. We hold each other's gaze, and I see that she knows the place I'm in. Ty stands abruptly, sliding his chair back, the legs making an awful screech against the tile floor. He reaches for my arm and pulls me to my feet. Call us if you have anything, he says. Anything at all. And we leave the room. We walk down the hallway, silent all the way to the rental car. Once we're inside, we sit, staring out the windshield while cars pull in and out of the parking lot around us. I can't believe this has happened, I say, my voice barely audible. What if they don't find her, Ty? What if we never see her again? He shifts in his seat, reaches out, and pulls me to him. I press my face against his shirt, and the tears gush up and out of me. My sobs are painful, wrenching from my chest with volcanic force. I cry until I have nothing left inside me. I'm limp with grief, and in contrast, Ty holds himself stiff as if it's up to him to keep me from completely dissolving altogether. You can't think like that, Lizzie, he finally says, rubbing the back of my hair with the palm of his hand. We have to stay strong for her. I don't know if I can, I say. The waiting. It's horrible. I know. But let's think of it as every minute that passes is a minute that brings us closer to seeing her again. Will we? See her again? I nod, mute. Yes, he says. Yes. And I hang on to that, like it's the strongest limb on the strongest tree standing right in the tornado's path.
51. Wren. Something hits me in the face, and I come awake from a dead sleep. I sit straight up in bed, forcing my eyes open. Sophia starts barking from the pillow next to mine. I reach for her, telling her to hush, only then realizing someone is in the room. Gretchen stands a few feet away, holding a newspaper in her hand, fury altering her normally placid expression. Did you just hit me with that? I ask, rubbing my jaw, and then awareness settling in. What are you doing here, Gretchen?
Good question, she says. If I had an ounce of common sense, I'd put myself on the opposite end of the globe from you.
I run a hand through the back of my hair and say, you're most likely right about that.
You ass!
She screams, throwing the whole newspaper at me now.
How could you, Wren?
I pick up the paper, seeing myself in a photo with Lizzie. We're kissing in San Gimignano, the sun setting just behind us. I feel a stab of longing in the pit of my stomach, longing for Lizzie. I miss her so much I have to close my eyes against the wave of pain.
I wanted to come here with you, and you said no. You wanted to be alone. Right. Did you have her planned all along, Wren?
Gretchen, no.
No? Who the hell is she anyway? Some housewife from Virginia? That's my competition?
She starts to laugh then, and I realize she's been drinking. Hey, I say, why don't you get a shower and some sleep, and then we'll talk.
Oh, sure,
she says, waving a hand in the air and stumbling backward in her heels.
As long as you can put me off, you're fine. Right, Ren? Well, you're not putting me off anymore. I'm a model. A supermodel. I have fans. Guys hit on me all the time.